Welcome to another Bjerknes podcast. CO2 taken up by the ocean helps reduce the atmospheric levels, but what impact does this have on the oceans and the ecosystems they support? I'm Stephen Outen, here with my colleague Ingjald Pilskog.
Good day.
Atmospheric CO2 levels are reduced thanks to absorption of CO2 by the world's oceans, but this disrupts the balance in the oceans as they become more acidic. Researchers from the Bjerknes Centre are involved in monitoring the ocean's CO2 uptake and in assessing and predicting the impacts they will have. We're joined today by two specialists in chemical oceanography, Ingunn Sjelven, senior researcher at NORCE, and Micah Becker, researcher at the University of Bergen. Ingunn, Micah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Ingunn, perhaps we could start with you. We often hear this phrase, uptake. What is actually the process? What are we discussing here?
So we are discussing that CO2 is taken up by the ocean, and the uptake is actually a purely diffusion process, and CO2 molecules are going both into the ocean and out from the ocean.
So is this a naturally occurring process, or is this related to sort of man-made climate change, or is it just something that's always happening?
Well, it's always happening, so it's a natural process. But what have changed after the Industrial Revolution is that more and more CO2 is taken up by the ocean, and this is steered by an increasing pressure of CO2 in the atmosphere, which forces more CO2 into the ocean.
So just having more CO2 in the atmosphere, you're just putting more into the oceans constantly.
Basically, because the difference between the atmosphere and ocean then increases.
So it really is just a sort of about the different quantities that you have in the two structures, the atmosphere and the ocean.
In the two reservoirs, yes, yeah. That's correct.
What would you say are the main impacts of CO2 being taken up by the ocean?
So, for the atmosphere, that fact that the ocean is taking up CO2 means that it keeps the atmospheric CO2 content lower than it would have been else. So if we didn't have the oceans to take up the carbon, the atmospheric CO2 content would be much higher than it is today, and we would already have a much larger problem. But the CO2 also, once it is in the ocean, changes the ocean. So it reacts with seawater and carbonate, and that leads to a more acidic ocean. And this more acidic ocean can affect all the animals and plants living in the ocean, but it also, a more acidic ocean will take up less carbon in the future. So that is a feedback cycle here.
Okay, so the ocean is taking up CO2 and making a sort of carbonic acid, and this is lowering the pH of the ocean, and this is sort of impacting.
Exactly.
What impact does it have on life in the ocean, the creatures?
A more acidic ocean. Well, maybe I should just first say that if we are thinking of a pH scale, we are not on the acidic side of the pH scale. We more talk about that. The ocean is getting less basic.
So it's less. It's not about ocean acidification so much as ocean less alkali.
Yeah, but that is very difficult to say. So we say it is an acidification because it's moving from the basic
side towards.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And a more acidic ocean means that, as Mike said, the pH is going down, but also that the availability of carbonate is going down, or chalk ions. And this has impact of the organisms that makes skeleton and shells of carbonate. Because if the concentration of carbonate becomes too low, they will have a hard time reproducing, and it will be stressful to live, so to say.
So this is actually a case of the shells that they have, they cannot reproduce them, they cannot create the shells very well, and the shells actually are becoming thinner.
Yes, the research has shown that the shells of some of these species has have become thin there. That's correct.
Is the concern towards sort of larger creatures like mussels and crabs, which the loss of which would, of course, impact financially fishing industries and such like? Or is it more towards sort of the very tiny creatures which form like a basis for a lot of the ecosystem?
Those two things are very connected. And if the smallest organisms with calcium carbonate skeleton are affected, that means that the larger organisms won't get the food that they're used to. So I used to say that eventually it determines what you and me can have on our dinner plate.
This is going to affect everyone.
It will affect everyone, yes.
So we have CO2 in the atmosphere and it's going into the ocean, and the amount of CO2 determines how much going into the ocean. Is there a limit to this process? Is there a limit to how much CO2 the ocean can take up? And is there any limit in how fast the ocean could take it up?
If the atmospheric CO2 content would just rise and rise, that is just driving more and more carbon into the ocean. But there is a there's a time factor here, because what is limiting a bit for the ocean to take up a lot of carbon is the transport of this carbon into the deep ocean. So when we have a stable atmosphere, then the surface ocean will take up a lot of carbon, or it is in exchange with the atmosphere. But then ocean currents transport this carbon to the deep, and at other places, water from deeper layers comes up to the surface and will then take up more carbon. And this transport process will lead to carbon uptake. But at some point, of course, in the far future, at some point, these heavy carbon-loaded waters will also come up again. So if the atmospheric CO2 is not increasing anymore, then at some point, maybe the ocean will turn into a source of carbon to the atmosphere. And we don't really know how, where, and when. Well, some things we do know, but then also the ocean is changing under climate change. So maybe some of the ocean currents are going to change. Maybe the biodiversity and how biomass is growing and remineralized might change as the oceans are warming. So all these things might affect how carbon is transported inside the ocean.
Clearly, it's really important that we actually monitor CO2 in going into the ocean and how this is changing. This is actually part of the UN's Sustainable Development Goal 14, which is on the topic of sustainability for the ocean. You're actually both involved in different ways in monitoring the ocean and the CO2 uptake. Perhaps you'd like to tell us about Station M, which sounds like something from a spy thriller.
Yes. So Station M is a fixed weather station that was started in 1948, actually. And the reason for it was that the air traffic between Europe and America increased after the Second World War. And then to save money, they needed better weather forecast and also rescue options in case of emergency. So then this International Aviation Organization started 13 weather ships in the North Atlantic in 1947-48. And the northernmost of this was in the Norwegian Sea, and it was called M, or Station M. So it was the phonetic alphabet. Yep. And from this was made as an meteorological station, but from the very beginning, also researchers from the Geophysical Institute here in Bergen, they started using this ship to also monitor the ocean, which has resulted in some of the longest time series of the deep water on Earth, actually.
Yet another legacy of great research coming out of the GFI over the years. What's the status of Station M now? I mean, how is the monitoring going on there now?
Well, luckily the monitoring is ongoing, but the weather ship, the last weather ship, was closed down in 2009. But as I said, luckily the monitoring is continuing by using mooring and surface buoy for some period of time, and also we use research vessels that occasionally is visiting the station. Mm-hmm. So it's still ongoing.
And you analyze the data?
Engineers at the University of Bergen analyzed the data, but I'm responsible for this time series. And we, back in 2001, we started the carbon time series from this site.
What have you found?
We have found that, first, the CO2 content in the surface water increase, which is not a surprise because we are emitting larger and larger amount of CO2.
That's sort of since 1948, or that's just since...
No, that's since 2001 when we started the carbon series. They didn't have carbon measurement back in 1948, so that time series started later. And also we find that that this carbon is, as Meike told previously, we see signals of increasing carbon also further down in the water column. And we see also that the water column from the surface to the deep is getting more acidic.
We've heard previously on the Bjørknes podcasts how the ocean is sort of separated and the upper layer kind of keeps quite distinctly apart from the deep ocean. It's difficult to mix down to the deep ocean. So ocean acidification is not just a surface process anymore. It's actually going down.
It is. And that is not due to mixing in the Norwegian Sea, but it's due to transport of water from elsewhere, because the deep water mixing in the Nordic Sea is primarily in the Greenland Sea. And what is the name of this sea west of Greenland?
Labrador Sea. It's also in the
Irminger Sea. But it's not going everywhere.
Has there been any studies on how this is affecting sort of the sea life that you have in the deep ocean? Because the deep ocean has some very different types of sea life.
When you are very, very deep in the ocean, concentration of availability of carbonate ions are so low that carbonate will dissolve. That means that in these areas there is no solid calcium carbonate, and there is no organism with calcium carbonate skeleton. But what we see at Station M is that the area where you find this water with very low calcium carbonate ions is shallowing. So that means that sometimes in the future this water that is basically corrosive for calcium carbonate will reach the large amount of deep water corals. These deep water corals, they live between, let's say, 200 and 500 meters all the way along the Norwegian coast. So it's a bit different from the types that lives in Great Barrier Reefs at few meters depth.
Maika, you're also involved in monitoring. I believe you're involved in running a station as part of the Integrated Carbon Observing System.
Yes, so that's a European infrastructure that is monitoring the surface ocean. England actually also has one. And so there are scientists from all over Europe measuring surface ocean CO2. So we have ships, we have moorings and surface buoys. And there are autonomous systems installed on these ships and buoys, and they measure in the surface ocean. And the idea is to get an overview about what is happening, how much CO2 is there in the ocean, how much does it take up, and how is that changing with time. And here at the Geophysical Institute, we have a station on a container ship that is sailing from Greenland to Denmark and back. And this station is actually has 20-year anniversary next year. So that station has been established long before my time at the Geophysical Institute. And so we have, since 2004, we are running those measurements on this ship now.
What have you found?
Yeah, well, we can see that too, and the surface ocean is increasing. And we do see that some of the variability in CO2 in the surface ocean, especially during winter, is coupled to how deep the ocean is mixing. So in the surface ocean during a normal year, you will start out with high concentrations during winter. And then when spring comes, then the phytoplankton is starting to grow and takes up carbon from the surface ocean, and then the CO2 concentration goes down until somehow midsummer. During summer also, the surface ocean is warm and it's not, there's no deep mixing. It's a very shallow surface layer. And then when you come towards fall, the first storms come and it's cooling, and then the warm surface layer is increasing again and getting deeper. And then all this phytoplankton that has been growing there during spring and summer dies and sinks out of the surface layer. In the bit intermediate ocean, it is eaten up by bacteria, just like leaves on land are in during fall and winter as well. And then when this mixed layer is deepening to its winter, all this high carbon is mixed up again to the ocean, to the surface ocean, and then we see this increasing CO2 towards winter. The concentration in winter is dependent on how deep the ocean is mixing. The concentration in winter is also, we had that the difference of concentration between the ocean and the atmosphere is an important part in how much carbon the ocean takes up from the atmosphere. If we have higher concentrations during winter because we had a deep mixing event, then we take up probably less carbon that winter, or even if it's very high, then you might even release a bit of carbon to the atmosphere during winter.
So this actually feeds back constantly in a varying way back onto how much carbon's in the atmosphere?
Yes, in a way.
So these observing systems, they sound like they've been running for sort of 50, 60 years and more like sort of 20 years. And it's a constant process. But this isn't just local. This is global. There's carbon monitoring happening all around the world. Are there any gaps? Are there big holes in the network? Is anything, you've mentioned other ships apart from Station M that, you know, weren't used for this purpose and they've been decommissioned and removed, and have stations been closed down? Is the network changed much?
Yes, absolutely. It's always a It's also a challenge to get funding to continue all these measurements. And that's, it's an ongoing and very demanding process, I would say. But you are asking about white spots. And obviously the Southern Ocean, it's one of the places where we have least measurements.
But all of this, there's a global network doing stuff like I do on my ship and doing stuff like you do on Station M. And people are doing that all over the world. And of course, it has been changing. The time of weather ships is over. Nowadays, it's more autonomous instruments on buoys, but also on ships, but also on maybe Argo floats, on surface vehicles. So it's going into that, like, we're including more and more technology as it's developed.
I know there was a new WMO initiative for greenhouse gas monitoring that was approved this summer. Any ideas or predictions about how that will impact the monitoring of ocean carbon?
Yes, so we have been involved in this initiative, and I think this could be very cool because it, so far, this monitoring has been largely based on projects. Partly we have this infrastructure, but it's still kind of based on infrastructure projects. And to put this monitoring into a more
sustainable
permanent way, right? If we as a society decide, okay, we need to have an eye on carbon in and greenhouse gases, not only CO2, in the atmosphere or in the Earth system in total, then I think just the logical result of that is that we need to put that into, like, treat it the same way as we treat the weather observations in a way.
Build a solid system that just is the backbone of modern weather forecast, or in this case, greenhouse gas monitoring for the next 50, 100 years, part of society as a whole.
Yes, I think that's an important thing to do.
I would stress that time series are really important. You have to continue measuring. We have not found the final answer mm-hmm. yet, but we see worrying signals. So we have to continue measure, both in the surface water and the deep ocean.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you need to measure for quite a few years to be able to understand what is normal variability and what is caused by other things like climate change, changes in atmospheric forcing, stuff like that. Like for that, you really need to measure some 20 or more years. So
keep the monitoring going and don't break the timelines that you have. Don't turn them off even for short periods. Once again, we've come to the end of our podcast. We've been talking to Ingunn Schjelvan and Micah Becker about the ocean CO2 uptake. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
From myself, Stephen Outen, and my colleague Ingjald Pilskog, we'll hope you enjoyed the show and will join us again for another Bjørknes podcast.